thing happened.
Yeah. Ben doesn't have a mic.
Okay, I'll do it. And then we'll go into work session. So ready when you guys are.
Okay, the recording has started.
Okay. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Interim Committee on Finance and Revenue of the Oregon State Senate. Some business to take care of first. With a roll call, we're going to do that thing, colleagues, where you announce your name and whether you're on video or audio. So I'll just go down the list. Senator Findley.
Good morning. Senator Findley by video.
Senator Bertschiger. Senator Burdick.
Present by video.
Senator Canoe.
Senator Canoe, present by video.
Senator Riley.
Present by video.
And Senator Taylor.
Senator Taylor, present by video.
Okay, so we're going to start off by going into a work session. I'd like to go into a work session for purposes of committee bill introduction. As usual, support of introducing these committee bills doesn't mean support or opposition. It just gets them into the system. So, Senator Findley, I'll do that with a motion from you.
Thank you, Chair Hass. Chair Hass, I recommend to accept the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee bills as posted on the summary sheet within OLUS in meeting materials.
Senator Findley moves that we adopt the LCs listed on the summary sheet within the materials tab. Is there any discussion on this issue? I think we'll have Chris in a moment very briefly go through those just so we all know what we're dealing with here. But is there any discussion on these LCs? Seeing none, so ordered, the LCs are now officially introduced. Chris, do you want to highlight those very briefly? I know some of them are just placeholders, and that's a good explanation of what the summary is. So go ahead.
Sure. So at a high level, the first one, 2200, is a redraft of Senate Bill 1529. It's the broadcaster's taxation. So there were a couple of bills that didn't quite make it through the process in 2020. And I guess for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. Then we have a couple of reconnect bills. One is the regular reconnect bill, and one is a version that would end the rolling reconnect. So we would just go to a static connect. There are a couple, there's another placeholder that deals with property tax reform. It just removes Measure 50 from the Constitution, leaves it in statute. There's a senior deferral property tax program. It modifies it and extends it. And there's an LC that limits the pass-through entity preferential tax rate policy. Then you have 11 bills that are the tax credit extension. That's kind of the normal tax credit review process. Those go from numbers 2461 to 2473. And then, and I'm kind of reading down the list, and then we have four property tax exemption tax expenditures that are just simple extension bills. There is a marijuana tax expenditure extension bill. And then from 2647 down to 2652 are a variety of placeholder bills. These are the LRO study bills. That's just language. Those are placeholders. They have different, each one has a slightly different relating to clause. One might be property tax, one is personal income tax, one is corporate income tax, and so forth. 2791 is the bill for CAT adjustments. Right now, there are just a couple of things in there. One is related to certain types of grocery stores, and a couple of the other provisions are related to auto dealerships. And then the last two are also placeholder bills. We have 3258, which is a horse racing financing placeholder bill. And then the bottom one, the last one, 3269, is an LRO study or placeholder bill on a recent IRS proposed regulation. And that item is actually the further down on the list of today's agenda. So we can talk more about that at that point. But that's a very quick read through of the LCs.
Okay. I want to remind everybody to mute their microphones as we move forward here. Are there any questions from the committee on any of the LCs that we're introducing as a committee? I'm sure you'll hear a lot more about them in coming months. So the legislature made a pretty significant policy change in 2013 on tax credits, and that they would automatically sunset after 6 years, and we're well into that process. And I believe now some of those tax credits are going up for their second review under this process. And the reason this was such a positive change, in my opinion, was because before that time, you just couldn't get rid of these things. You couldn't even make changes or revisions. And with this, now the burden is on the constituencies of these, of the beneficiaries of these tax credits, to come in and prove why they should be renewed or changed or modified. And so that is what we've done in every session since 2013 in the Tax Credit Committee. And so the Legislative Revenue Office is putting up a credit report preview for the coming session. So I'll kick that over to Kyle to run us through that.
Okay, good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yes, segueing perfectly from that introduction there, what I do have for you today is really just a preview of what's going to be going on in the 2021 legislative session. That is the tax credit report and the review process that will unfold. And as was just mentioned, a number of the LCs that you do have in front of you today are that are to facilitate that tax credit review process. So I will go ahead. I do have a few slides I can walk through today. I'll see if I can get that shared with you all. It is the second, for those that are following the on OLIS, it is the second document in the meeting materials. Okay, so what I was planning to cover today is just a brief overview or review of the tax credit review process, give a little bit of background on tax expenditures and tax credit in general. Again, the plan here is to move through some of this background information rather quickly, because I know many of the members have been through this process many, in some cases several times before, as this is a process that the legislature has been following more or less since that 2013 session. But the general idea, as previously stated by the chair, is setting up a process where tax credits are reviewed. And the way that has been done was to place sunsets on the tax credits. And the key here with the sunset is, by placing a sunset on a tax credit, it sets the status quo is that that credit will go away absent a legislative change. So the way that it's been done in the past is these six-year sunsets have been placed on all the tax credits, and they're done so in more of a staggered fashion. So rather than trying to review all the tax credits in a single session, originally the tax credits were grouped with the idea of placement into a light category. So if you had tax credits related to, say, housing policy, you would review all those tax credits in one legislative session. And then in the next long session, you might take a look at tax credits related to education or something along those lines. And that way, the legislature isn't attempting to review all these tax credits all at once, but rather is taking a chunk of them every 2 years during the long session. And that's where the sunsets have set up, where you have different group of tax credits scheduled to sunset each long session. So in terms of what coming today, again, some of that background, I'll go a little bit into the report that's accompanying this review process that LRO is required to put together that provides some background information on that. And then I'll finish with sort of some of those themes of the 2021 credits that are scheduled to be reviewed and scheduled to sunset. And then, of course, I have the table listing the tax credits that are scheduled to sunset in the 2021 session and 2023 and later as well, along with those costs of just extending those tax credits without any modification. And again, that's the LCs you see in front of you today as well, is the LCs are just extending the sunset by 6 years. It's kind of a placeholder to allow this review process to take place. Just in terms of the general background, tax credits are in many ways a subset of tax expenditures. I have the definition that Oregon has put in the statute related to tax expenditure. The general idea here is that a tax expenditure is a way, you can view it as spending through the tax system, similar in the way a direct spending program might occur. So rather than providing a grant or a direct spending program, you're spending, if you will, through the tax program or the tax system through maybe providing a credit for someone to do something. So you could either provide a grant, that'd be a direct spending, or you could provide a credit, which then is doing, maybe meeting the same goal, but it's doing that through the tax system. But it's just key to keep in mind that tax credits are just one subset of tax expenditures. Now, other sources of information in addition to the tax credit report that LRO prepares, of course, is the governor's tax expenditure report. It's a companion document to the governor's recommended budget, which was recently released as well with the budget. And included in that report are the entirety of all tax expenditures. So again, credits are a subset of that. So these credits that are scheduled to expire are also included in the tax expenditure report as well. And included in that is the governor will provide a recommendation on whether or not these tax expenditures that are scheduled to sunset should be extended or allowed to sunset. And in the case of the 2021, just to bring it to your attention, the 21-23, the tax credits that are scheduled to sunset in 2021 that will be reviewed, the recommendation from the governor was to extend all those sunsets with the exception of the individual development account contributions credit. And there's some nuance there of why I think that occurred, and we'll get to that a little bit later when I get into the individual list of credits. And then the last thing is, I think I touched on this, again, credits are just one subset of different tax expenditures that exist. So of course we have Oregon subtractions, and then many of tax expenditures exist as connections to the federal tax code as well. One thing of note, and again, this is kind of a preview of things that will be coming in the 2021 session, is this specified and implicit sunset. So again, the legislature, in part of facilitating that review process, placed sunsets on all the tax credits, or nearly all the tax credits that are on the books. And in part of that process, the legislature also enacted what's now ORS 315-037, that is for tax credits that are enacted by the Legislative Assembly going forward, they would more or less, if it's not explicitly provided in the enacting legislation when that tax credit will sunset, it automatically gets that 6-year sunset. And in many cases, this hasn't come up because as new tax credits are proposed, they often will include a sunset in the piece of legislation that's proposing the new credit. And in many cases, the 6 years has become somewhat of a status quo, where sometimes when a new credit is being introduced as a piece of legislation, the question now has in some ways become, well, the status quo is that 6-year sunset, so is there a reason to deviate from that? Should it have an 8-year, maybe a 4-year? And if nothing is included in the legislation, then it gets that automatic 6-year sunset. And this originally started with just tax credits and then was extended to all tax expenditures that are enacted going forward by the Legislative Assembly. And there are some nuances to this, how this statute works. And again, the legislature will be receiving a report here in the 2021 session from LRO relating to this exact topic. So it's just one of those things, just wanted to put it on your radar of something else that'll be coming to you in 2021. So in terms of specifics of the report, so as part of the tax credit review process, the legislature required LRO to prepare a more or less a background document related to the tax credits that are scheduled to sunset in the upcoming session. So in this case, in 2021, we'll be including a report that provides information that, with the idea or the intent of that report, is really to be helpful in the legislature or facilitating helpful in the legislature doing that review process for the tax credits. And this report is required in statute. It does have some, what I've labeled as deliverables in the report, and things that we focus on in the report are the things that, these are the things that are listed that the legislature would like us to look at. And one of the key, I guess, key things that's a requirement is the stated policy purpose of the credit. And I say that's key because that really does start, that's the beginning of where the analysis can then move on from. Where if you think identifying the purpose of a credit is step one, and from there you can then work to try to think through, well, is this credit achieving its purpose? And if not, maybe it needs to be modified, maybe it can be allowed to go away, allowed to sunset, all a host of different options that come up. But the really the starting point there is, well, what is the purpose of that credit? And the legislature has really identified that as a key piece of trying to identify that so that they know, well, how are we to view this thing going forward? And to that end, also included ORS 315-044 is this statement of purpose. So again, the legislature saw that, well, to effectively evaluate these credits, we really need to understand why they exist to begin with. And so now there is a requirement for a proposed tax credit or an expansion of a tax credit. It is a requirement to include a statement of purpose provided by the chief sponsor or a proponent of the measure of essentially saying, what is it that the credit does? And one of the things that, again, has helped to bring this statement of purpose to the forefront is included in the revenue impact statement that LRO prepares. There's a box that gets checked where it says, does this piece of legislation enact or modify an existing, expand or enact a tax expenditure? And there's a checkbox simply yes or no. And if the checkbox is yes, so this is a new tax expenditure, whether it's a credit or some other tax expenditure or a modification to it, we'll check that box as a yes, and then also included there would be a policy purpose statement. And the idea there is that statement is usually going to be trying to condense, I guess, the discussion that's happened at the committee level and by others of what it is that this credit or this tax expenditure, what is the purpose of this, and trying to identify that in hopes of being helpful to the committees and the members as they're looking into this, and also in years in the future when we're looking back and trying to review one of these, look and see, well, what was the purpose identified at the time that this credit was enacted? So that's all included, or those are the things that are identified in the report. One other thing of note, this is usually in the appendix, is also a requirement is doing more or less a look back on the revenue impacts that have occurred in the past. So we include a table at the end of the report that looks at, okay, what was the revenue impact statement? What was put out there, the cost of this tax credit in the past? And then now that we have information to say it's coming from the tax returns on how much this actually costs, and is there a big difference there? And I think the idea is that it's helpful if, when reviewing a credit, if the original thought was maybe this is going to cost $2 million per biennium, and it turns out that it costs $12 million. That could be important information for the legislature to have in their review process to see, well, is the cost of this credit similar to what the legislature thought it was going to be at the time it was actually enacted? So in terms of the process itself that's occurred in the legislative process of reviewing these credits, again, this is how it's historically been done. It doesn't mean that's necessarily how it has to be done in the future, just as this is how it's done in the past few sessions. But you can almost think of it as three stages of the review process. And the first being the interim process, and I think in many cases that's the credit report that LRO is that we're preparing, and that's doing the background information, talking to the different stakeholders and administering agencies to really put together a background document that hopefully provides a good amount of information that's helpful to the legislature in their review process. The second stage is really that actual process taking place during the session. And the way this has worked in the past is you have the standard six-year sunset extension bills. In this case, you have these ledge concepts that have been generally been introduced as committee bills. And these bills are just the standard six-year extension. So there's no policy modification built into them. It's simply a way to facilitate this discussion. And these bills, with the standard six-year sunset for each of the individual credits, have generally been assigned to a policy committee that oversees maybe what the credit is connected to or linked to. So again, if we're talking a credit that's related to housing, then that credit would first be assigned to, say, a housing committee. And this would happen in both sides of the chamber. We have a bill on the Senate side and the House side. And that would give the policy committee an opportunity to review the tax credit as well and kind of look at it in terms of what are the other programs and apply their subject matter expertise to reviewing the credit. And there's a subsequent referral for these bills, generally to, it's either going to come due to the House or Senate Revenue Committees, or in many cases, it'll generally go to the Joint Committee on Tax Credits for a secondary review through the Revenue Committees. So it's really the idea is, well, the policy committees will get a first chance to look at this. They can, if they can make suggest modifications, they can amend the bill, pass it out, and then it goes to the Joint Tax Credits Committee. Or it could be allowed to sunset, and that'd be a way of the policy committee saying, we reviewed this, we don't think it's still necessary, or something to that nature. And again, so in that case, the bill just wouldn't be forwarded out of the committee. It would just stay there. But that's a general view of how the process, again, has worked in the past since this sort of six-year standard tax credit review has been put in place back in 2013. And generally, I think once it gets to the Joint Tax Credits Committee, the discussion in some cases may change a little bit from what was also discussed at the Policy Committee, in that the Joint Tax Credits Committee is often viewed in some ways a ways and means approach, if you will, where you start looking at all these tax credits, the cost of all those tax credits, and then the funds available to whether it is to extend those or not. So it, in some ways, it, that does link to this whole tax credit review process is sort of looking a little bit from a ways and means approach of, well, how much money does the legislature feel they have to spend, if you will, on extending these credits? I think I've touched on what it is the LRO tax credit review report will consist of. The one thing I would add here is that in the past, we have presented the specific information to the policy committees when they're reviewing this credit as well. So it is something that we try to do where we will go, again, to a policy committee and try to provide the background information where we can that can help that policy committee in their review process as well. So as was mentioned by the chair in the introduction here of this review process and report, 2021 does represent, in many cases, the second iteration of review for these tax credits. So most of the tax credits that are up for review and sunset in 2021 were reviewed in 2015. So back in 2015, when this process first began for this group, there were 19 credits that were reviewed, 9 of which were allowed to sunset. 2 credits were combined into a single credit. 1 was more or less spun off from an existing credit. There were 6 modifications to the credits, and then 2 were extended unchanged. So there was quite a bit of work done back in the 2015 session related to these credits, and even some that has certainly taken place since 2015 as well, further modifications that have occurred. But what that resulted in is in 2021, there are 11 tax credits to be reviewed right now, or scheduled for the standard review process, 10 of which were reviewed or created maybe in 2015 if they're spun off or a combination credit. And then we have one new credit that was created in 2017. So that's really the only one that hasn't gone through this review process already. So I do have here a list of the themes of the credit review for, so these are the themes, if you will, going forward for the 2021. I will touch on these points, but I think it's probably more helpful if I just skip ahead to the actual listing of the tax credits that are scheduled to review. And this is a document that many of you are probably fairly familiar with. This is our standard one that we provided in the past, but it's providing the estimated of the cost to extend of the tax credits. So what you see in front of you right now is the list. This is the list of the tax credits scheduled for review in 2021. All of these tax credits, with the exception of the last one, are scheduled to sunset as of 2022. So it's important to keep in mind all these tax credits are on the books through tax year 2021. So as of right now, there's still one more year of where taxpayers will be able to use these tax credits. So, and that's where the legislature has the opportunity in the 2021 session to deliberate on these credits on whether to extend them or not. And that extension will begin in 2022. And that's key in that you're really looking at half of a biennium worth of the cost of these credits. Normally a biennium would consist of 2 tax years. In this case, the review process splits that first biennium, so the cost is of roughly half in 21-23 versus 23-25. But the way to view this table is just we have a listing of the tax credits here, and then the numbers or the dollars here are the cost to extend those. So in some cases, you can view this as this is the loss in revenue that would occur by simply extending the sunset of these tax credits. There's no modifications, but just a simple extension of the existing law that's in the books right now. And as you can see, the total cost is about $50 million is the expectation for 21-23. And then again, as that is only half of the biennium, you only have one tax year there, the cost roughly doubles in 23-25 and 25-27, with some growth built in there as well. In terms of a theme, I guess one thing to highlight is similar to the last credit review process that took place in 2019, you can see one credit, in this case, the Working Family Household and Dependent Care Credit, represents about 60% of the overall cost, $31.9 million of the $50 million. And this is somewhat similar in some cases for those of the members that were part of it or remembered from the 2019, when the earned income tax credit in that case represented a large amount of the total cost to extend. So that's kind of a theme of 2021 when viewing these in total. Another thing is trying to group these credits. So you have a number of these credits. In this case, I've listed it as, just to go back to the slide for one moment here, the Public University Venture Development Fund, contributions to the Office of Child Care, and individual development account contributions. These three credits in many ways work. They're a credit that for contributions made to an account, or it's a credit created in some ways to incentivize or to leverage private contributions. So if someone makes a contribution to the Office of Child Care, they would then receive a credit equal to a percentage of their contribution back. That's the amount of the state tax credits. And the idea here was really to try to, in some cases, leverage those contributions that are made to these accounts to then use as a funding source for that account to then use to support their programs behind which the funding goes to support. And I just wanted to highlight this in some cases because, and I know Chris will touch on this a little bit later in an agenda item, is the environment for these three credits has changed a bit with a 2018 IRS rules and regulation that was released related to the deductibility of these contributions made when you receive a tax credit. And so just to touch on the topic, but not to go into too much detail, the change really that occurred, or I don't know if it's a change, but these rules and regulations that the IRS put out made it very, stated it very, very plainly that if you make a contribution, let's continue with the Office of Child Care example, you make a contribution to the Office of Child Care, and then the state, in this case, Oregon, gives you a tax credit for part of that contribution. You then can, the IRS is saying, well, you can no longer deduct that full amount of that contribution you made as a charitable contribution. Rather, it's just the increment of the contribution amount. So if you contribute, if you get a 50% credit, you donate $100, you get a credit equal to $50, you could deduct the other $50 as a charitable contribution, but you can't deduct the full $100. And that was, the law didn't change at the federal level, but it may not have been as explicit. It certainly wasn't as explicit as it is now that you have the rules and regulations saying, no, you can't do this, you know, double deduction, if you will, at the federal level. Now, Oregon already had statute that more or less protected against that from occurring, but there were, the key here is that there were opportunities for certain taxpayers to potentially have a net benefit from making one of these contributions when you account for the tax credit at the state level and the potential to do a full charitable deduction at the federal level. So with that change at the IRS level, that definitely can influence how people have made contributions going forward. And I think that's part of the reason, and some of you may have already heard about this, the Individual Development Account Contributions Credit, the IDA program, the governor again recommended that credit to be allowed to sunset with the idea of then you could shift it to more of a direct spending program in light of the recent, I think it's probably fair to say, struggles of receiving the same amount of contributions that they have in the past post this 2018 IRS change to the rules and regulations. And the last things I highlighted here was just how to try to categorize some of these other credits. You have the, what I've labeled here is income maintenance, but it's related to the working family, household, independent care credit, severe disability, and child with a disability. In some cases, you can maybe think of them as also entitlement credits, where it's, if you qualify for them, you then receive the credit amount. We also have a group that's more related to healthcare with rural medical providers, the veterans home physician, and then the OHIGA assessments, again, touch on healthcare in a somewhat an indirect way. And then the last one is maybe a category for, if you want to call it business, which in this case, there's two credits, the bovine manure for biofuel, and then the employee training eligible counties. And again, there's, it's not necessarily very easy to put these credits. They can often, could be put into multiple categories. So it does make it difficult sometimes to say, oh, these are clearly, these credits fit only into this box, especially with something like the working family, household, independent care credit, which goes to support working families that have children in childcare, essentially. That can touch on a lot of things. To say that simply exists for this one reason is probably an oversimplification, because again, there's a lot of reasons that that credit exists, and there's a lot of ways in which it might provide an incentive or a help in a household doing A, B, C, D, or E. So lastly, the last thing I think I'd probably touch on is what you see in front of you here is page one, and these are the tax credits that will be reviewed in the upcoming session. Also included then on page two are the remaining credits. So you have the ones listed for 2023 and then 2025. And so these 2025 ones, this list will look somewhat familiar, and that these were just reviewed in 2019. But part of just in how to read this table, it's important. The reason you see zeros here is because these credits are on the books right now today. So they are not scheduled. They're scheduled to sunset in later biennium. And that's why there is no cost to extend in 21-23 for these scheduled to be reviewed in 2025, because they're essentially on the books right now. So they aren't scheduled to sunset until midway through the 25-27 biennium. And that's the reason you see the zeros and the final cost to extend really represent those tax credits that are scheduled to sunset right now under current law. But again, that's a bit of the high level review. And I'd probably just leave it there, and I'm happy to take any questions, any specifics or anything like that. But again, we are working towards completing that report, and that is the tax credit report that LRO prepares is something that we'll be delivering to the legislature at the beginning of the 2021 session.
Thank you, Kyle. Appreciate the work you've done on this. I think the tax credit process has evolved over the years. We made this big change in 2013. Many thanks to you for that. But with this evolution, and by the way, I have PTSD on carrying that bovine manure tax credit bill on the floor a few years back, and so glad to see it's somebody else is going to do that this coming time. But as good as this process is, it's way better than the old days. Senator Burdick will remember when we had these runaway train tax credits we just couldn't do anything with. As good as it is, there's still some what I would call funkiness in it. And one of those is there's nowhere in statute where a number is set. And so I would implore the revenuers and the tax credit committee to, at some point, the leadership of the House and Senate and Ways and Means co-chairs and revenue chairs have to agree to a number. That's central to all of this. And that's what gets us to the Ways and Means process that Kyle mentioned. Without a number, there's no discipline. It's ordering off a menu with no prices on it. 50 million to renew everything. Say the number comes up at 40 million. Everybody agrees you have 40 million to spend, and that means, okay, now you're gonna have to make some modifications, or some of them won't get through, or maybe it's 60 and you can add or make some changes. But having that number is central to this whole process, and it's a really important process for the revenue committees in the form of the tax credit committee. So thanks, Kyle. Are there any questions of Kyle on the tax credit process going forward? Senator Burdick?
Thank you. Just a little bit of history. It was actually not 2013. It was 2011 when we were going through the worst part of the economic shutdown or the economic recession. And our budget situation was dire. And in that session, that was the first session we actually had the sunset in effect. The sunset bill passed in 2009. And in 2007, it went into effect, and the Betsy credit, the infamous Betsy credit, was one of those credits. And I still remember the meeting in the president's office where we were told, your $40 million worth of tax credits that you're considering here need to go down to $10 million. We actually had the process you refer to back in 2011, and it really worked well. It was very tough. There were many, many meetings in windowless offices to get down to that $10 million. But I couldn't agree more that that's the kind of discipline we need to rein in these credits. The bill was an important first step, but it needs stronger implementation.
Yeah. Thank you. Any other questions on this topic? Okay. We have next on the agenda what we have titled as the Oregon State and Local Tax Burdens Report from the Oregon Business and Industry Organization. Scott Bruin, former state rep, is here. Scott, I'll bring you up and let you introduce your guests and give us an overview here. And I'd also like to welcome to our committee hearing Senator and Commissioner-elect Bert Shiger. Good morning, sir. And Scott, we'll let you take it away. Scott, unmute.
That's what I was checking, sound check. Okay. Is that better? All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. It's a pleasure to be here. I am Scott Bruin. I am the new Director of Tax and Fiscal Policy for OBI, Oregon Business and Industry. And I am joined this morning by Caroline Soley, who is Senior Manager and Economist for Ernst & Young based out of San Francisco. Also by Doug Lindholm, who is President and Executive Director of the Council of State Taxation based out of Washington, D.C., and also, until she has to go to another meeting, by Nikki Dubay, who most of you know, who is a tax partner for Eversheds and Sutherland. This morning, we are going to present very efficiently to you a robust study that was completed by Ernst & Young and the State Tax Research Council, the State Taxation Research Institute back in October, and then was updated after the November election, which really gets into the Oregon state and local tax burdens. This report is, as I said, is robust and has been uploaded. Chris has uploaded it to for all of us, for everybody to see when they have the time. I've been with OBI for about a month now. One of the very first things I did was wade into this study. And I have to tell you, as somebody who spent his life in business and for a time in public service, this study is very sobering. It really lays out in clear, concise terms Oregon's competitive position in regard to business taxation and how that's changed pretty dramatically in the last couple years, and really what that means for our ability to compete for investments as well as do the job creation, the job retention that we want to do. So really that's the compendium. We'll spend some time talking about it and then, of course, open it up to questions from the committee. Let's kind of start this morning. I'm going to ask Doug to come on and kind of set the table, if you will, from someone who looks at state taxes across the nation, and then we'll go to Caroline. So, Doug, go ahead and take it away. And then I'd also ask Chris if we could bring up the PowerPoint.
Great. Thank you, Scott, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee. You can hear me okay, I guess?
Yes.
Scott referenced STRI, the State Tax Research Institute. That is the 501c3, the foundation that is operated under COST, the Council on State Taxation. I am the head of COST, and over the last 20 years, one of the sentiments, and I've been doing state tax policy work for at least 20, but one of the sentiments that we hear most often in terms of taxing business is we're just trying to make sure that businesses are paying their fair share, which is a fair question, but it in turn begs two additional questions. That is, how much are businesses actually paying in total state and local taxes? And two, what is a fair share that businesses should be held to? We, in response to those questions, we commissioned the folks at Ernst & Young, in which Caroline is as part of that group, 18 years ago to start an annual business tax burden study. And that evaluated all of the state and local taxes by state that businesses paid. And it is a long list. It's property taxes, it's excise taxes, it's gross receipts taxes, local taxes, sales taxes on business inputs. And it was never put in a one single place before. The upshot is that businesses paid about 44% on average of all state and local taxes. In Oregon, at least a couple years ago, Oregon fared fairly well there. Their burden was much lower than 44%. But over the last 2 years, there have been, as you were well aware, significant tax increases in Oregon. And OBI asked us through Ernst & Young to do an analysis of the tax burden and the change in tax burden in Oregon over the last 2 years. And the upshot there, again, and Caroline will go into more detail, is that over the last 2 years, taxes on businesses have increased by 41%. Now, that's a significant jump. It's taken Oregon from below average to above the national average, and it's an unprecedented jump. Over the 18 years we've been doing this study, we haven't seen anything that approximates that jump. So I will turn it over now to Caroline to have her go through the details of the report. Caroline?
If I could jump in here real sure. quick, Doug, I think we need to introduce if you could introduce yourself just for the record.
My name is Douglas Lindholm. I'm the president and executive director of the Council on State Taxation in Washington, D.C. We represent primarily the Fortune 1000 on state tax policy issues nationwide.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Doug. Good morning, everyone. I'm Caroline Salee. As Scott mentioned, I'm a senior manager in the quantitative economics and statistics practice at EY. And I've had the opportunity the last 8 years to work on the report that Doug just mentioned, which is the 50 state business tax burden study that we do in conjunction with the Council on State Taxation. And so we are well suited to take on the work that was proposed by OBI, which was looking at the impact of state and local changes on the tax burdens faced by businesses in Oregon. So I'm going to spend about 10 to 15 minutes walking you through our analysis and what we found, and then we're happy to take questions. Can we go to the next slide? Thank you. So here's a quick summary of what we did and what we found. So in this work, we looked at four recently passed state tax changes. We also looked at three recently enacted tax changes in the Portland metro area, and we looked at five local ballot initiatives. So these were initiatives that were on the November ballot. And there's a couple things I want to just let you know about our analysis up front. So first, we looked at the taxes and we looked at what is the impact once these taxes are fully phased in. So some of the taxes, particularly one of the major state taxes, the paid family medical leave program, that tax does not become effective for 2 years. But we did an analysis that said, once the taxes are enacted and fully phased in, what is the impact? So that's the first point I want to make. The second point is that in order to compare what is the impact of the tax changes compared to current baseline, we estimated the tax changes for fiscal year 19. So we put everything into fiscal year 19. So we could do that comparison. Here's what the current state is, and here's what the tax changes mean. The third point that I want to make is that we compared the business taxes paid as a share of economic activity, and we use gross state product as our denominator. So throughout the report, when we talk about the total effective business tax rate, or that acronym TEBTR, that is business taxes divided by gross state product. So just so you know, that's how we calculated our tax burden. So what did we find? Well, as Doug mentioned, we found that recent tax changes result in about a $1.8 billion increase in business taxes once they're fully phased in at fiscal year 19 levels. So that's a 41% increase in business taxes. Second, that increase in taxes on business results in that effective business tax rate going from 2% of economic activity to 2.8%. So corresponding with that 41% increase. Third, Oregon then dramatically changed in our business tax rankings. So as Doug mentioned, we look at taxes in all 50 states, and Oregon was one of the lowest state business tax burden states. They were at 40th highest, or 10 lowest, another way to say that. And once you layer in these business tax changes, they then fall in our ranking to 19th highest. So they go from being a below average tax burden state to an above average. And then finally, we are in interesting, unusual times, and we wanted to look at how COVID-19 could potentially affect these results. So we also looked at how is COVID-19 disrupting some of these tax revenue streams for the state and local governments, and do our results still hold when we factor in the impacts of COVID over the next few years? And so we did some modeling around that, and we found that levels might be a little lower, but we do think the results that we present still hold when we look at, well, what are these taxes going to collect? What are the burdens imposed in fiscal year 22, even with COVID? So that's the state tax side. On the local tax side, we looked at taxes in the Portland metro area. And when we looked at the taxes that were recently enacted and the ones that were approved on the November ballot, so many of those go into effect in January, when you layer in all of those and once they're effective, we found that those tax changes would increase taxes on Portland businesses by 23%. And that's a combination of city, county, and metro area taxes. The sixth finding then is that what happens if we take what's happened in Portland and we add it to local taxes statewide, and what happens to that local total effective business tax rate? And we found that that effective tax rate increases from 1.8% of economic activity to 2%. So we did see an increase there. And then finally, when we add the state and local taxes together, we found that Oregon's total effective business tax rate increases from 3.8% in fiscal year 19 to 4.8%, which is above the statewide average. And I'll talk about these findings in more detail as I go on. So can we go to the next slide, please? Thank you. So here's just a quick overview of the approach. And given the time that we have together, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I just quickly want to run through sort of what is our approach at a high level. So the first step is looking at, well, what do businesses pay in the most recent year that data are available? So for that, we use fiscal year 19 data. So we constructed a baseline business tax data, and we follow the methodology that we use with our studies with cost, where we look at, is the tax liability, is that on business? Is a portion of it on business? So for some taxes, it's pretty straightforward, where we can say all of the tax is allocated as a business tax, whereas for other taxes like property taxes, we divide out depending on the property class. So we do some of that apportionment of some taxes. So that's the first step. Second, we look at what are estimates of the revenue impact of the business tax changes. And we relied on third-party revenue estimates. So that is mostly government reports or at the local level, local budget documents, things of that nature to estimate what is the impact of the tax change. We also did verification on our own. You know, we calculated some of the taxes based on us pulling some data to verify that we thought that was in the right ballpark. So that's the second step that we did. Third, we then calculated what is the new business tax burden given these new taxes. So this is the with tax change calculation. And then finally, we could then benchmark, well, what is that new tax burden? How does Oregon compare to neighboring states and other Western states, and leverage the study that we do with cost? And then finally, as I mentioned, we looked at COVID-19 impacts and we modeled out which tax revenue streams we thought were going to be most impacted by the pandemic. And we relied on Oregon Office of Economic Analysis forecast to help us with that work. Can we go to the next slide? So these are the state tax changes that we looked at and how we estimated the $1.8 billion change. So first, we looked at the corporate activity tax, which I know this committee is very aware of these taxes, but we looked at the corporate activity tax, and we, again, estimated an annual amount of that tax at fiscal year 19 levels, and 100% of that is a business tax. Second, we looked at individual income tax rate reductions and the offset on pass-through business income. And so we have a small reduction, as you can see, on business taxes due to those rate reductions on pass-through income. Third, we looked at the extension of the tax rate, extension of the tax and the increase in the tax rate on the insurer premiums tax and the assessment of managed care organizations. So that increased from 1.5% to 2% in the extension of the tax until 2026. And then finally, we looked at the paid family medical leave program and the funding of that tax, which is a 1% payroll tax, and that is split between employers and employees. And we've included the 40% employer share in our analysis. So in the table, you can see the business share, you can see the business tax estimates, and the $1.8 billion that we estimated once the taxes are fully phased in. Can we go to the next slide, please?
Excuse me, Senator Hess, can I ask a question, please?
Mm-hmm.
Senator Taylor, do you have a question?
Thank you, Chair Taylor. So here on page 4, you're referencing, so first of all, thank you for this. This is very informative. You're referring to the second line here of the individual income tax. And I know we're here talking about business taxes, so I'm trying to understand, because we here in Multnomah County also passed a different individual income tax. Is that part of this analysis, or is that not a, or did you determine that should not be factored into anything? I'm not quite sure. I knew we were talking about business taxes, but now it says individual, and so now I'm curious. Mm-hmm.
So on the individual income tax, we have apportioned only the part of that tax that's paid on pass-through business income. So it's only that business portion of it. So you can see the business share is 10% of that tax. Okay. And we also looked at the tax changes in Multnomah County, and it's the same activity. So I will talk about that in the next two slides.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. So let's go to the next slide, please. So we looked at three taxes in the Portland area that were enacted prior to us starting this work in October. So we looked at the Portland gross receipts tax, which is the 1% gross receipts tax on large businesses that went into effect in January of 2019. Second, we looked at the Multnomah County business income tax rate increase that went into effect in January of this year. And then third, we looked at the metro income tax. So this is on the three county area, the tax that was passed by voters in May that funds housing support services. And that tax is a combination of a 1% tax on business profits. And we put that revenue estimate as purely paid by business. And we looked at 10% of the individual income tax portion of that tax as taxes paid on pass-through income from businesses. So again, to the point, we've only taken a very small set of the individual income tax that's only applicable to pass-through business income. Can we go to the next slide? So we looked then at five ballot initiatives that were on the November ballot, four of which passed, one that did not. So three of the tax changes that were approved by voters were property tax increases. So you can see here the first one, the Portland Parks property tax was passed, an increase in millage. Second, there was an extension of a debt millage for the Portland Public Schools. And then third, Multnomah County Library tax, property tax, was also approved by voters. So two new taxes, extension of an existing tax on the property tax side. And Multnomah County also passed an individual income tax to fund universal preschool programs in the county. And that tax has two components. It has a 1.5% tax on certain levels of income on higher earners. And there's different levels for single and joint filers. And then that rate bumps up to 3% when it on income that's over $250,000 if you are a single filer and $400,000 for a joint filer. And again, we only took the portion of that that would be applicable on pass-through business income. So 10% is the business share shown in our chart here. And then the fifth tax was the Metro payroll tax, which was rejected by voters. And that was by far the largest tax that was on the ballot, and voters rejected that payroll tax. Let's move on, please. So because of the tax changes that were approved by voters in Portland, we did a quick comparison of what does the top marginal individual income tax rate look like for Portland residents at the state and local level. So you can see all the way to the left of your screen, that red bar, that is now after in January of next year, what is that in January coming up, what is Portland's individual income tax rate going to look like for at the highest level, and it's 13.9%. So it's going from the current 9.9%, and there's a 4% increase. And that puts Portland ahead, has a higher tax rate than San Francisco and Newark. So we did that quick comparison, just the level set of where Portland is now going to be starting in January. Can we move on? Here's a more detailed look at the state tax changes that make up that 41% increase. As I mentioned, you know, the four sort of tax changes are highlighted in gray in this chart. So the paid family medical leave program and the corporate activity tax are the big ones. Those make up about $1.6 billion of the $1.8 billion increase. And then we layered in the premiums tax, and then also what are the reductions on the individual income tax side on pass-through business income. And so you can see that here in this table. Can we move on, please? Great. So this puts the change in state business taxes in context, and it compares Oregon to some of its peers and to the national average, to that U.S. state average. You can see the U.S. average in that light gray bar, which is 2.4%. So business taxes as a share of GDP nationally for the states is 2.4%. Oregon was below that at 2% prior to these changes. And once all the tax changes are phased in, it'll go to 2.8%, and it'll be higher than neighboring states, California and Idaho, and also higher than Utah and Arizona in this list. Can we go on, please? Thank you. This just shows what happened at the local level, that 23% increase in Portland taxes. And this is a combination of the city tax changes, the Multnomah County tax changes, and the share of metro taxes that are applicable to Portland businesses. So that is part of, and the ballot initiatives that were passed. So that includes those as well for that 23% increase on taxes. So this is in addition to Sorry. This is in addition to the state taxes. Can we go back a slide, please? Thank you. This just quickly shows what is happens to the statewide local effective tax rate. So a little bit different concept here, but we took the Portland taxes, I'm sorry, the Portland area business taxes, we added it to the local taxes paid statewide, and then we looked to see what happens to Portland's effective tax rate so we could compare it nationally since we have that data. So pre-tax changes, Oregon's statewide local effective business tax rate was 1.8%. It goes to 2% with the tax changes. It jumps ahead of California. It's higher than Washington and Idaho as well, but it's still below the U.S. average in the latest data we have for fiscal year 19. We can go to the next slide. Thank you. So this just puts together the state and the local analysis. So this is adding in the statewide tax changes, the local tax changes, and the overall TABAR going from 3.8% in Oregon to 4.8%, which is above the national state average of 4.5%. Next slide, please. Again, this is just putting it in context for you. Sorry, the labels are a little small, but you can see the red bar is Oregon post-tax change, and prior to the tax changes, the green bar, that 3.8%, which was below Utah, Arizona, Idaho, California, and now Oregon is ahead of all those states, including Washington, and is above the U.S. average at that 4.8%. Next slide. As I mentioned, the results we found still held with the COVID, looking at the impact of COVID-19, we modeled through sort of what are the projections for various business taxes in fiscal year 22. We're expecting, you know, the corporate activity tax is going to be lower, that those tax collections, same with insurance taxes. Since the paid family medical leave program does not start until 2022, we felt like our fiscal year 19 estimate was about right for actually where it's going to be in a couple of years. So when we modeled through all of the reductions in some taxes, no change in others, et cetera, we found that our results were pretty similar to what we presented here. And so we felt like even with COVID, when we looked at it several years out, our results still hold. All right, next slide. So just in conclusion, as I mentioned, you know, our analysis, we found a large increase in state business taxes. We found that Oregon went from being below average to above average in effective tax rate and falling from 40th highest to 19th highest in the analysis. And on the local side, we found a 23% increase in taxes for Portland businesses and a statewide increase in that effective local effective tax rate from 1.8 to 2%. So in the name of time, I will stop talking and we're happy to take questions.
I appreciate your comments on this. I guess I would direct a question to Doug. This raises this dilemma you've probably seen in other states is from a state perspective, it's been my goal, at least on public finance, to have certain goals when it comes to taxation, fairness, make your taxes broad-based, keep them in context with what else is happening, so you can have at least loosely some broad public finance policy goals. But when you have local governments, for example, with some pretty enormous taxes, throwing wrenches into our policy goals, there's not much we can do about that. And I don't blame at all the city of Portland and Multnomah County for doing what they need to do. But for example, income taxes, we in fact lowered them last time as a goal to ease volatility. Volatility has been always one of the bugaboos in Oregon's system. But when a local government raises income taxes so that those people in that area are now paying the highest income taxes in the country, that's a dilemma we face. And again, it was their right to do that. You've probably seen this in other states. What suggestions would you have to try and get states and local governments to coordinate a little bit better in terms of overall tax policy?
Thank you, Senator Hass. That is, you're spot on, a very difficult dilemma. Although I do have to say that localities, municipalities in Oregon have tended to be a little bit more aggressive in asserting their tax powers. Ohio does the same thing, but I think that there needs to be recognition that whether the taxes raised are at the local level or at the state level, there's still a significant burden on the companies operating within those jurisdictions. And I'd like to see that states exercise a little more authority over locals, which is really tough to do. But there needs to be recognition that it's the combined burden that companies are going to look to when they make assessments about whether to expand in Oregon or relocate to another jurisdiction. Because it is especially the bigger companies, it is an incredibly competitive marketplace out there. And, you know, people say, well, you're making a lot of money. If you take a look at the list of the Fortune 500 15 years ago, 20 years ago, and the companies who are on it now, it's probably changed 60-70% because of the competitive nature of business. So companies will try and take advantage of lower costs wherever they can find it. And, you know, I wish I could offer you a better solution about how to deal with the locals. That's a tough one. You know, one other comment. In Oregon, as you're aware, because of its unbalanced system, lack of a sales tax, the U.S. average sales tax is imposed on business inputs at the rate of about 42%, which is kind of a hidden tax. It's not transparent, which is why Oregon fared fairly well, you know, prior to the CAT, but because it doesn't have that sort of lack of transparency. You know, the lack of transparent tax on businesses that other states do. So, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. I think Senator Riley and Senator Taylor have questions. Senator Riley, you're in the queue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed in all this analysis, there's nothing about what the benefit to the companies is to any company. There's nothing which talks about what do you get for the taxes you pay.
You want me to hit that one, or Caroline, you want to hit that one?
Yeah, I'm happy. I think Doug, I think you and I are going to have the same response, which is that's a great point, and we do that in our 50-state tax burden study for cost. So we do that calculation, which is what do businesses get for their tax dollars? And we do that cost-benefit analysis of here are the taxes businesses pay and an estimate of how the expenditures benefit business. So we do have that in our annual study at the state level that does that calculation. So that's an excellent point. Doug, do you have something you want to add?
Yeah, let me elaborate that, because that is critical. It gets back to my first point about what is a fair share. Well, first, we all understand that any tax on a business is going to be reflected someplace on an individual, right? Either it's through higher prices or lower wages or a smaller return on investment for the owners. And that last group, that's who legislators really want to get at, is the owners, right? They're the ones that are making all the money. The difficulty is if you try and target something to just the owners, it's very easy to move that investment. Now, having said that, there is, it's called the benefits principle, a school of thought that suggests that businesses should at the very least pay for the benefits that the state is providing, infrastructure, education, and that's absolutely fair. So what we did and what the folks at ENY did is that they took a study done by the Chicago Fed years ago about what types of expenditures actually favor business in the state. And the big question there is education spending. How much of education spending can be seen as a benefit to business? It certainly is an individual benefit. It is clearly a societal benefit, and there's no clear answer there. So what the Chicago Fed did is they expressed a range. They said some people think that 0% of education spending affects business, and it goes all the way up to others that say as much as 50% should be attributed as a benefit to business. And so in the study, which is, if you'd like to take a look at it, it's on our website, cost.org. It's on the very front rotating page. it shows how the various states cover the benefits that they are provided. And the tax burdens generally are, even if you assume that 0%, even at the other end, businesses pay more in taxes than they receive in benefits. So, and again, that's not just a study done by EY, it's based on a study from the Chicago Fed of the benefits principle specifically.
Okay. I just want to add one more point. I just looked up the number for that ratio for Oregon in our latest study, and we have estimated the ratio is 1.0. So we have at 50% of educational spending benefiting business, we have each dollar of state and local taxes in fiscal year 19 that businesses pay, they get back an equal amount of benefit. So that ratio will change going forward because new taxes start layering in next year.
That was before the 41% increase.
Exactly.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
Senator Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Hatz. So I, like Senator Hatz and others, are worried about the stability of our tax system here in Oregon. I say tongue-in-cheek often in our committee that no other state seems to want to be replicating Oregon's system. I don't know if that's true or not, but it sure seems that way from where I sit. With that being said, one of the other challenges I feel, and I probably won't be very popular for saying this, is that there seems to be something happening with states that have the ballot initiative process. And I'm curious for the analysts, for Caroline or for Doug, whomever feels comfortable answering this, about how, I don't know if that's part of your research or if you take that into consideration, because as Senator Hatz just said, I mean, some of the biggest increases or changes that have occurred have not necessarily occurred through an actual legislation or a city council or a metro or something that goes to the vote of the people. And there are many benefits to having a ballot initiative process. Sometimes things happen where I don't know that it's always beneficial. So I'm just curious about Oregon in relationship to other states. The states that you see that have the most stable tax systems, and I don't know if that's a subjective term, I'm not sure exactly, do they have a ballot initiative process or do they not?
You want me to hit that first, Caroline? So I think, and this is purely my personal opinion, that it is a dangerous thing to secede tax policy decisions to the people. Not that they don't know what happens, but because there's typically a delayed effect, right? If they make a decision and there's a reaction to it, things have to go bad before they make another decision to fix it, unfortunately. So the Western states tend to be the states that have ballot initiatives. Oregon, Washington, and California have been the most active. The other factor here that I know you guys struggle with is the lack of a sales tax, because in those other states with a balanced three tax system, sales, property, and income, both individual and corporate, they tend to balance each other out. The income tax, especially corporate income, is volatile because when companies are not making money, they're not paying tax. But the sales tax is probably the most stable tax, which helps those other states avoid the volatility. So again, you guys are stuck with a tough deck to play, a tough hand to play, but that may be why.
Follow up, Senator Hess?
Senator Taylor.
Thank you. So perfectly acceptable for you to share. You started up by saying your personal opinion, and I appreciate your laying out the landscape there. I'm just also curious from you or from Caroline, Ms. Sally, that what is recommended? Is it to have the average of all the taxes? That is always what I learned. That's what I learned in graduate school was, in economics, was that having the average of all taxes, especially for a low population state, that is better than having some of these more extreme ones. But I don't know, I'm not an economist. So I'm trying to understand as we move forward as a state, we need to make some decisions because there's going to be ramifications for some of the things that have happened. Some of them will be good, some of them will perhaps not be so good. I'm defensive about paid family medical leave because I was the champion on that bill, and that's fine for the analysis to occur here. I would also say that there's a lot of benefits there, and we'll have to see how that plays out, stabilizing the workforce, et cetera. And also in that example, there was a serious movement here in Oregon to take that initiative, to take paid family medical leave to the ballot. And what would have happened, and Senator Birchiger knows this all too well, is that what was under discussion was having it be 100% employer paid. Okay. And so we needed to, we made it, you know, and obviously the vote happened and here we are now. So I'm just curious about what is recommended to have. I mean, I believe in holding everyone needs to pay their fair share, and that's the question at hand. So my question is for a state like Oregon, with the business makeup that we have, with the population that we have, and the industries that are currently available or realistically available to us in the near future, what would be the ideal, not politically, because I agree about we need a sales tax. I have no problem saying that I would support a sales tax. But what is the recommended from economists about what should Oregon be striving to do in order to make our tax system more stable? That's kind of the million-dollar question. What do we need to do to stabilize things?
So I'm a tax lawyer, and Caroline is the economist in the room. So, Caroline, do you want to hit that first? And I have
I appreciate the analysis, but now we've got to, you know, we are in a situation we need to go forward, and these are the, yeah. the I'm going to be super unpopular and get a million texts for everything that I'm saying, but that's hard to stop. So
I think I have to tread carefully because my company will not like me saying certain things. I agree with you, though. I think it's the staying away from the extremes that's really important. So, you know, we put up the individual income tax slide for the Portland area in context because there are so many businesses in that area and people who are high earners are mobile, and we are seeing this. I mean, I live in the Bay Area. I live in Oakland, so we're seeing this happen in San Francisco. So, you know, I think there's that component of staying away from certain extremes, particularly when people can move and they can take their assets with them and they can take their taxable income. And we have a summary in the report that goes through what is the research around that and what is the impact of increasing those tax rates. And then I think the other question is, what do you do when, how do you create stability, and how do you, in the fact that you don't have a sales tax, and that's a big problem, and I'm agreeing with you there, that you have, Oregon has a different set of challenges because you don't have a sales tax. So I would agree with what you were saying, and that I think from the economist perspective, we're always concerned with, well, what are the trade-offs and what are the unintended consequences of activities that put you in the extreme? And I think a lot of what we're showing here is that because policies are being made in their own realms and there's not a lot of dialogue between what is happening at the local level, how is that combined with what's happening at the state level? I think the research was commissioned just to put that together and then inform and create a better picture. Now the challenge is, what do you do with that? And how do you legislate in a way when you can't coordinate as much? So Doug, I don't know if you have your perspective on this.
Yeah, let me make two comments. And you know, because I have seen states struggle with this. The first one is you're at a particular disadvantage because without a consumption tax, a consumption tax is stable, and it is the generally accepted by economists to be the tax that is the least harmful to economic growth and competitiveness. It's least influential on business decisions. So starting with there, and I know that everybody says, well, get a sales tax. What I've seen other states do, though, is, you know, Oregon has a lot going for it aside from business climate. And, you know, those are its strongest advantages. And what other states have done, and we can take some others, Massachusetts, North Carolina, Alabama, they have focused on what I think they call them centers of excellence, particular business groups that they want to say, look, if you're a high-tech company, you want to be in Oregon. If you're in Alabama, the auto industry is located there. In North Carolina, the banking industry. In Massachusetts, it's high-tech. If you focus on specific industries and build sort of a symbiotic growth factor, then it can help overcome some of the other disadvantages you've got with your unbalanced tax system. Now, you know, that's not for me to suggest which industry, but that could be something to, or which industries. And again, the danger there is you can't leave the rest of the society behind when you do that. So it is a bit of a delicate dance, but that, I have seen that work in other states.
Senator,
thank you,
and
Commissioner-elect Burchard. Thank you, Chair Hass. You know, in the 8 years that I've been on the Senate Finance Revenue Committee, I've looked at a lot of states, a lot of taxations, not just here in our country, but other countries. And, you know, I've come to the conclusion that a little bit of property tax, a little bit of income tax, and a little bit of consumption tax, sales tax, seems to be the most balanced approach. However, the political atmosphere here in Oregon, as we know, is the citizens have declined to be interested in the sales tax. So we're stuck. The problem with businesses or people is if we get into an overtaxation situation, they just vote with their feet and they leave. Well, we can see that in California and we can see that in New York. And I think we're going to see that in Oregon too. As far as businesses relocating in Oregon, taxation is big, not just for the business itself and how much taxes the business has to attract employees. And those employees are going to look at the tax situation. And if it has high taxes in a state, the employees are going to want more money to work for that business. Also, it's all the vendors for that company, too. And it's, so it trickles down. But finding that balance, I mean, you have two things that you have to do. You have to run the state, manage the state, and you also have to keep businesses here, and you also have to keep people here. And it is tough. And Senator Mark, you and I have had lots of discussions of how to find that balance. But I think the legislature needs to keep looking hard. I just got back from a business meeting in another state a few days ago. And even though those businessmen had nothing to do with Oregon, they basically asked me, has Portland lost their minds? Who would want to relocate a business to Portland, Oregon? So I think we really have to start looking at these things, the legislature, and really try to get back to some balance of create a system that will fund the state adequately, but also invite businesses and people to stay, remain, and conduct business in Oregon. It's going to be tough. So that's my lecture for today. You don't have to listen to me for too much longer. Thanks.
Thank you, Senator Burchard. Appreciate that. We'll end this subject on that note. I want to thank OBI, Scott, Doug, and Fairlick for coming forward. Appreciate your time here today.
Thank you so much for having us, committee, Mr. Chair and committee. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
You bet. So going from a tax burden on business to a more positive development for at least some businesses. There's been a recent IRS proposed rule change that if the state, with the state's help, should be good news for some Oregon businesses. So I'll let Chris Alanak walk us through that. It's rather technical, but I think this is as close to what we get to good news for that tax burden for some Oregon businesses. Chris?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Chris Alanak, Legislative Revenue Office. So in OLIS, there is a document, it's about the fourth or fifth down, it's IRS Notice 20-75. It's pretty thick. It's IRS speak. So you can read that at your leisure. But I wanted to describe in layman's term kind of the situation. So what this deals with is the SALT limitation, the state and local tax limitation on federal tax returns. So this is the deduction that personal income tax filers take. It's their Schedule A deductions. and taxpayers are allowed to deduct state and local taxes usually. For Oregon, it's income taxes and property taxes. For other states, it's a combination that taxpayers get to choose either their sales tax or the income tax. So when households file their tax returns, they get to deduct in Oregon those income taxes and property taxes against their federal tax. Part of the Tax Cut and Jobs Act was to limit that deduction to $10,000. So if I'm an Oregon filer and I had, say, $8,000 in income taxes and $5,000 in property taxes, prior to the TCJA, I could have deducted those full $13,000. Since 2018, I can only deduct $10,000. So that was part of a revenue-raising piece at the federal. One of the things to keep in mind here, we're talking about the interplay between state and local taxes and federal taxes. And since the TCJA came on and the SALT limitation came into play, states have had a variety of discussions of ways to offset that, and we've had some of those here in Oregon as well. What this proposed regulation does is affect a subset of personal income tax filers. And these are part of the folks that you heard about from in the OBI presentation. These are the business owners for partnerships and S corporations. And basically what this proposed regulation does is say that for entity level taxes, so that means a tax imposed on the partnership or the S corporation, those taxes are fully deductible against that business's income. Now in Oregon, we don't have any such taxes. Right now we have a minimum tax. So partnerships and S corporations have to pay a $150 tax. It can sometimes get characterized as a fee. It's just a flat $150. So what the regulation does and the opportunity with the interaction of the SALT limitation is to say that if a state imposes that entity level tax, then those taxes are fully deductible. So what the opportunity here is, and this is laid out in LC 3269, to model something after a New Jersey policy, where it's possible for the state, for Oregon, to implement a revenue neutral policy for Oregon revenue and Oregon taxpayers, so no new revenue, but by shifting where that revenue comes from, taxpayers can feel the benefit of lower federal taxes. So let's just talk about $10 million. If the state were to impose an entity level tax on S-corps and partnerships, the pass-through entities, and collect $10 million. So that raises $10 million and simultaneously create a corresponding tax credit equal to that $10 million. Then that shifts where the tax comes from. So as an example, say I'm a member of a partnership, and my situation was the one I described a couple of minutes ago. I'm paying $8,000 in income tax, and this is my personal situation. I'm paying $8,000 in income tax and $5,000 in property tax. The property tax is my home, and the $8,000 is my total income. It's the wages of my spouse and my income from the partnership. So if Oregon were to create a policy and create that tax on the partnership so that the partnership pays a total tax of, say, $20,000, and my portion of that is $5,000, then my personal taxes would go down from $8,000 to $3,000 because the partnership would pay the tax, and then I would get a credit of $5,000, so my personal taxes would go down from $8,000 to $3,000, and it brings me under that $10,000 cap. So there is, between me and my share of the partnership, more of the state and local tax, more of the Oregon taxes get deducted against the federal taxes. So then from my perspective and the perspective of the partnership, there's more of that, there's less federal tax, and there's more of that money staying in the hands of the business and me as a personal income taxpayer. Now, there are a lot of details to be played out here, and that's why LC 3269 is just a placeholder right now. It's an LRO study concept. But the idea there is that there does, the IRS, with this regulation, appears to be laying the foundation and giving their okay to these kinds of state-level policies, where on the one hand, Oregon raises X amount of dollars from these businesses and allows a corresponding and equal amount of tax credit to the owners of those businesses on their personal income tax returns. So at the risk of over-explaining, I'll probably stop there, or Mr. Chair, I can stop there to see if there are any questions.
Let me just throw on some color that you're sort of duty-bound not to go into. I appreciate that, but some of you recall this was seen, fairly or not, as an effort to punish blue states, particularly New York and California, other high-income tax states, and Oregon fell into that category. And so if Oregon were to go through this workaround, put something together, it would unwind that and make these taxpayers in this category whole. So just for context, that's this is what this issue is about. Questions? All right, thank you, Chris. Finally, today, thank you for your patience. We have an update on the category called technical cat fixes. Chris?
From the Department of Revenue, we should have Exan Culver and Katie Lawley connected. So I'll give them a check in, second to make sure they are unmuted.
Hi, Chris. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
And this is Exan Culver.
All right. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll toss it off to you.
I'll go ahead and share the
PowerPoint. Thank you. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Katie Lawley, the Business Division Administrator at the Department of Revenue. And as Chris mentioned, I also have Exan Culver here today. She's our CAT Policy Coordinator. We're here to provide an update on the implementation of the Corporate Activity Tax Program, otherwise referred to as CAT. That's probably how I will refer to it today. The CAT was passed by the 2019 legislature in order to provide more funding for education in Oregon. And yes, we can go to the next slide. Thank you. This is our project dashboard. Overall, you can see that the project is on track with all those green on-track signals to be completed on time and on budget. Because of the size of the program and the time frame that we had for implementation, we began work on this in July of 2019 by beginning to build the team, produce project documentation, and determine the scope of the project. The major project activities are coming to an end in the near future. You can see that by the green bar there in the middle. In the near future, with the official end of the project being next July, that will allow us time for the team to make any necessary changes once returns have been filed next spring and to complete the project closeout activities. The project breaks out into four different areas that we're going to cover today: budget and staffing, communication and outreach, policy and systems, and IT system configuration. Many activities within these areas are already complete, and like I said, we're just really getting down to the wire here to make sure that the whole program is ready to go early next year. Next slide, please. This is our budget slide. Like I said, the CAT project is on budget. We received funding for our startup expenses from the 2019 legislature. That was the beginning. And then we received an additional other fund limitation that was approved during the second 2020 special session in Senate Bill 5723. Total funding that was approved for this biennium is approximately $13.8 million. This includes the startup expenditures as well as staffing to begin administration. Major activities that are funded include project staffing, IT configuration, printing and postage, and costs for communication and outreach. Through October, we've spent approximately $4.8 million of the allocated budget. And then hiring staff. sorry, you can go to the next one, thank you. In addition to the initial team that began during 2019, we've continued to keep our positions filled in order to complete the work necessary to implement the CAP program. Recent hiring activity includes 3 limited duration administrative specialists. They will handle the expected influx of phone calls from practitioners and taxpayers as they begin preparing their first CAT returns early next year. We're also recruiting for 6 permanent tax auditors that will begin training in February next year. And we'll be beginning a recruitment for an office specialist to assist with management of correspondence and providing clerical support for the CAT team. And I just want to mention that the CAT team, much like the rest of the world, has, because due to COVID, has shifted to remote work and almost 100% really since April of this year. And the strength of the team and their leadership has really shown through in the ability to get the work done and resolve any difficulties while working fully remotely. Next slide, please. Okay, IT system configuration broke out into 2 phases. This slide shows phase 1, which included registration, allowing for taxpayers to register online, go online and manage their accounts, make estimated payments. All of this was completed early in 2020 with Department of Revenue resources. Next slide. Phase 2 of our IT system is currently on track to be complete in early January. This work includes configuration for return filing, filing enforcement audit, collection, and reporting. The status on this specifically is that the initial programming is complete. We recently completed unit testing and systems testing, and the final stage of testing, which we call end-to-end testing, began November 23rd. Like I said, we're on track to go live in January. This will allow taxpayers to start filing their first year's tax returns. Once the system is live, we'll move into a 6-month stabilization period, when this is the time where we can address any needed changes that occur after live returns are received. And then other system work that is underway or complete includes getting our front-end systems ready to capture paper filed returns, working with e-file vendors to allow CAP forms to be electronically filed. And with that, I will turn it over for the next slide to Roxanne.
Good morning, Chair House, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roxanne Culver with the Oregon Department of Revenue. To inform businesses about the new tax and requirements to register and make estimated payments, we sent letters and emails, issued press releases, and held in-person and virtual meetings. Letters were sent to more than 682,000 businesses and individuals reporting business income on 2018 tax returns. Those letters informed them about the CAT and the requirements. The most recent batch of informational letters were sent in October and November to 33,000 businesses that had not yet registered for the tax with the Department of Revenue, and those businesses had reported business income in prior years. We've issued 40 press releases and 58 email updates to our CAT mailing list with nearly 10,000 subscribers. We also made use of 2 social media platforms, Twitter and LinkedIn. Public service announcements are going to begin airing on local Oregon television and radio networks in late December and in the first quarter of the 2021 calendar year. We held 2 outreach tours. The first in fall of 2019, where meetings were held in 12 cities across Oregon, and 2 conference calls, which allowed for out-of-state stakeholder participation. In those meetings, staff gathered input from stakeholders regarding issues and areas of ambiguity where guidance or rules were needed from DOR. The second tour in March of 2020 provided training on the rules and answered questions from attendees regarding specific requirements. We were able to hold 8 of these sessions across Oregon before the tour was cut short by the COVID-19 pandemic. We are grateful to the Southern Oregon University Small Business Development Center for recording and producing a video from the Ashland session. That video was posted to our website for stakeholders who were unable to attend one of the in-person sessions. And just a few months ago, in October, we held two online meetings with a briefing on the tax requirements, policies, and rules, where participants were able to ask questions and receive answers. A full list of those questions and answers from the two online meetings is available on our CAT webpage. Emails were sent directly to all registered CPAs and licensed tax consultants in partnership with their state licensing boards in January and September, providing up-to-date information and reminders about the CAT. The department engaged directly with various industry groups to discuss any sector-specific concerns. For example, we met with the Oregon Business and Industry Council on State Taxation, Oregon Farm Bureau and their sister associations, the Oregon State Bar, Oregon Society of CPAs, and associations from specific industries such as the insurance industry, the medical field, grocers, and many others. Our webpage is updated regularly and includes information about the tax, the frequently asked questions, and a worksheet to estimate payments. It also includes training materials. We have a specific phone line and a help email box staffed by a team of folks dedicated to answering taxpayer questions. The dedicated call center was put in place in late February. We received over 10,000 calls and the average wait time is 14 seconds. We've also received and responded to over 3,000 emails to our help email box. At the very end of this presentation, you will see links to both our help email box and our website, and then also our Twitter and LinkedIn accounts. And the phone number for questions is also listed. At this time, as I mentioned before, we are creating a series of short videos and the public service announcements. The short videos will provide specific aspects of the corporate activity tax, including videos which provide guidance for the filing the CAT return, COVID-19 tax relief options, and other topics that have garnered specific interest from stakeholders. Those videos will be posted to our website later this month. Next slide, please. Thank you. The department has adopted 24 permanent rules so far. These rules provide guidance to taxpayers on a variety of topics, including sourcing, estimated payments, exclusions, and sector-specific guidance. One additional rule is in process for adoption regarding the exclusion for damages received from litigation, and one rule amendment is in process to reflect changes enacted by House Bill 4202, which passed in the first special session. We're preparing for the first return filing in April. We've received letters of intent from five software vendors to provide e-filing options for the 2020 corporate activity tax return. We are coordinating with those vendors as they program their systems. The form, the actual return itself and schedules will be posted to the DOR website when the 2020 tax forms are posted for all other tax programs. Next slide, please. So here we are today. This is the latest look at the statistics of the program. On the slide, it says we had 19,043 registered taxpayers. As of Monday, December 7th, we have 19,113. So it has increased by 70 taxpayers over the last week. We've received just over 20,500 estimated payments, which total nearly $662 million. We've disbursed just over $424 million to the Fund for Student Success, and the next distribution is scheduled for. I would like to remind you that these dollars are reflective of estimated payments only. We won't know the true tax liability for the 2020 tax year until those returns are filed. The returns are due April 15th, but taxpayers may request a six-month extension to file, although that is not an extension for time to pay. The number of registered taxpayers will likely never total the number of businesses that are subject to the corporate activity tax, while businesses must register within 30 days of exceeding $750,000 of commercial activity, only those businesses with over $1 million of taxable commercial activity will have an actual tax liability. Next slide, please.
Okay, so this is our commitment to you and to the rest of Oregon. As we near completion of this project, we remain committed to ensuring transparency in the implementation process by including external partners in our project updates, and doing presentations like these, administering the CAT equitably, effectively, and efficiently by creating fair rules and ensuring that our staff are trained, engaging closely with stakeholders from across business and industry in regard mostly to administrative rules and other guidance that we can provide, and also providing taxpayers with all the tools and information that they need to comply with this brand new tax. Next slide, please. This really completes our presentation today, but we're happy to answer any questions that you have.
Thank you both. Appreciate that update on the CAT. I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that and more from you. Any questions on the new CAT committee? Okay, thank you. Appreciate it. Committee, thank you for your patience today. It's been a long day. My dogs are telling me they want to go out, and so I think that brings us to a conclusion. Good luck to you in 2021 on tax credits and CATs and all things in that category, and I hope to see you soon.
Senator Hess.
Senator Taylor.
I wanted to end, but we need to. We acknowledged you yesterday in the Labor and Business Committee, but I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge you again, and thank you for your service here, not only in the legislature, but of course here in the Revenue Committee. You did, obviously, you've been an amazing chair, and it's been a privilege to serve with you. So I just wanted to acknowledge you before we sign off.
Too kind, thank you. Senator, question about that IRS rule?
This is Senator Riley. I want to echo that. I've worked with you for the last 6 years on this committee, and it's been a pleasure. I've watched you do some really hard work and get some good results, not only in Revenue Committee, but also with some interesting things like full day kindergarten. You've done some great work, and we're going to miss you a lot. And thank you for all your service.
Thank you, Senator Riley. I appreciate working with you. Senator Findley, you had a question about the IRS rule?
No, actually I don't, but I would like to say thank you. I mean, I've only had the opportunity and pleasure of working with you this last year. I've truly enjoyed it. I've learned a lot. You are truly a statesman, and I will miss you dearly. I wish you well in your next endeavor. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Senator Findley. Senator Knopf, you wanted to ask about the CAT tax update.
Yeah, I did. You regret that? No, I also wanted to say how much I'm going to miss working with you. I've known you for over 20 years, going back before you came to legislature when you were doing those hard-hitting investigative journalist reports. But we've worked on campaign finance. We've worked on student success and many other things over the years, and you've been a great voice of, I think, of intelligent policy and moderation, which I think is incredibly helpful. And so we'll truly miss you here in this building, and hope that you'll check in on us from time to time and make sure that we're on the right path.
Thank you, Tim. Appreciate that. Senator Burdick, you had a question about the Tax Credit Review Committee.
No, that was a good presentation. I want to associate myself with everything that's been said, and especially I've worked with you for a number of years on the Revenue Committee. We were partners in crime in revising the tax credit system, which I think has been a positive addition to our revenue system. It's just been a true joy working with you. You've just been such a good statesman and a good partner on so many important issues, and we all just owe you a great debt. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank all of you for being patient on this committee. I think we all had a pretty good run. It's been good working with you. You all have made me better, keeping me in line. So many thanks to the committee and to the first-rate legislative revenue staff, Chris and all the economists, and Corinne and everybody there. So thank you all. This isn't fare thee well. I'll be in touch. I'll try not to be that old cranky uncle who yells at you from the sidelines, but I will be in touch. So thank you all. Merry Christmas.
Bye.